Sessions is off the chart. I do 3 hours of analysis every weekday, two on the radio, one on TV. With that much verbiage, I'm going to make mistakes and misstatements. And when I do, the far-left smear websites are going to headline them. That's the game they play. But mistakes are mistakes, and they must be corrected. A couple of weeks ago, I said the unemployment rate in Mexico is 40%. That's wrong. The poverty rate in Mexico is 40%. I misspoke. Now, the New York Times was kind enough to point out the mistake, and then reporter Simon Romero wrote, the Mexican unemployment rate is, quote, closer to 4%, 4%, unquote. That, of course, is nonsense. The Mexican government puts that out, neglecting to define any standards of the stat. The truth is, the Mexican economy is a disaster with per capita income a quarter of what it is here in the USA, which is why millions of Mexicans are willing to come here illegally and work brutally hard.
What's the U.S. real unemployment rate? Now that we know that they include people who are in the military as being employees, employees for the ruling order, that aspect is true. But we know the games that they play. And if you're in unemployment long enough, you just evaporate into thin air. What about that aspect that's changed? So before you go talking about how bad Mexico's economy is, which is tied to the global capitalist economy, which is an indictment on the capitalist order itself, maybe you should look at home. But then again, you're paid by people who are part of that ruling order circle, and telling the truth about what's going on may lead you to be unemployed. Even though we know that when it comes to intelligence and integrity, unemployment within is definitely where you're at. You know what time it is. Slave Revolt. Check it out. You're listening to 103.3 FreakRadio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 107.5 North Carolina, now 96.3 in Antelope Valley, out in the LA area, LUVER.com, the world, RadioForAll.net, the universe. Click in the Slave Revolt web. Just go Google Slave Revolt Radio, find out what time it is. And check out the propaganda press, Fellow Slaves in Resistance, on their website, propaganda.org. Tonight, we're going to jump right into Wars Made Easy on Sam's Plantation. Check it out.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know, the black experience provides a rich resource of the injustices that are served out by the state. And often, when the issues that concern black are ignored by large portions of the population that claim to be engaged in social justice movements, much resource and analysis and fields of attack against this machine often go amiss. We're going to explore this a little bit with Dan Baum, author of the book Smoke and Mirrors, as he goes into a discussion about how this past and current war on drugs, like war on terror, has been a very effective vehicle to create, amongst all other things that the order wants, a form of a free market law enforcement type of apparatus. We're going to tie some of these things together as we go step by step in outlining the aspect of in this Beyond the Shadow segment, how wars made easy on Sam's plantation. So check this out.
Forfeiture is quite the thing. Forfeiture has created free market law enforcement in the United States. Police now are desperate for funding. The same way state and local school boards and social service agencies have been strapped for funds by the property tax revolution and by federal budget cuts, so have state and local police. The one recourse they have, however, is to seize assets, to confiscate property in drug cases. We should add here that rapists don't lose their property, murderers don't lose their property, people who grow 5 marijuana plants in their basement lose their property. Most states, state law forbids that. I think California is one. State law forbids police directly benefiting from seized assets. However, since the 80s, any contact with illegal drugs, with a single marijuana cigarette, can be defined as a federal crime. So if the local DA or the local sheriff wants your house and wants to bust you for pot, for example, all he has to do is call the DEA and the U.S. attorney and say, come make this a federal case. Because under federal law, police are entitled to a cut of the asset, even if it violates state law. And this is why our federal prison system is exploding, because there's a huge incentive for police to make any drug crime a federal crime. They then get a cut of the asset.
So if you check out what Baum was talking about concerning the war on drugs apparatus and how the cops get a cut out of this, and how it further not only empowers the federal apparatus to seize upon the masses of people all in the name of war on drugs, you can see how just in the name of in a war on terrorism, a similar aspect takes place, as the wheels of encroachment by the state apparatus grind deeper and deeper into people's lives, and how once again, in the same way that on various local levels you have police financially benefiting from this war on drugs because they get a cut of the assets that they swoop up, you see that within this whole war on terrorism aspect on a national and global stage, various corporate mechanisms profiting off of this apparatus and enriching themselves. But part of the reason why this was you know, you see many people acting shocked about what's going on under this banner of war on terrorism, when actually it's overlapped with the war on drugs, with the because these wars made easy help further empower the state apparatus. They help further enrich the state apparatus. And it also changes through concepts of definition. So now, just about anyone in the banner of fighting a war on terrorism can be labeled a terrorist suspect. And then who knows what can be done with you, carted off into this country, countries that are allies to SAM, you know, for torture or whatever, carted off somewhere in American gulags or held indefinitely, all in the banner of a war on terrorism as they define it. Well, by the same token, you have a situation where drug crimes, quote unquote, are now redefined as federal crimes. And once that apparatus takes place, a whole nother mechanism steamrolls in with all other forms of state power backing. Because in this society where wars are made easy, the terror of the state, the beast, is what's really truly being unleashed. Now here Baum goes into how 80% of the people who've lost their property have never been convicted or even charged with a crime under this asset forfeiture madness. Check this out.
There's a great story about a man in Nashville named Willie Jones who owns a nursery and was traveling to Texas to buy shrubbery, and it's a cash business, and he had $9,600 in cash with him and went to the Nashville airport. He pulled that wad of cash out to pay for his ticket. Willie Jones is black. The ticket agent sees a black man with $9,600 in his pocket and assumes he's a drug dealer. At the Nashville airport, the DEA had a program whereby any ticket agent who spots a drug dealer gets a 10% cut of any money seized or any asset seized. She calls the DEA, they put him against a wall, they take his money away without arresting him, without charging him with a crime, without convicting him of a crime, give him a receipt for an unspecified quantity of cash, and it took him years to get that money back, and he didn't get it all back. They just took it. They later claimed that a dog barked when the dog sniffed it, saying that the money was tainted with cocaine. The Pittsburgh Press, which originally broke this story, did a smart thing. They withdrew cash from Federal Reserve banks all over the country, had it tested for cocaine, and found that 96% of the cash in the United States contains microscopic traces of cocaine, which means all the money in the United States is legally seizable. You take the cash out of William Bennett's pocket and put it in front of a drug dog, and the dog will bark. The DEA seizes this money, and then when it does, it doesn't clean the money, it doesn't destroy the money, it puts it in the bank to be seized again.
Now, once again, you can see how cynical, how diabolical this whole mechanism is. But without any kind of serious attack on what the state has been doing under the banner of a war on drugs for years, you can see the overlapping corrosion of rights. So here's someone who, Willie Jones, who deals in a cash business, takes out some cash just to pay for a damn airline ticket. Now you have a situation where it's an embedded snitch type culture, just like in the war on terrorism. Slave listeners have heard me play that little speech where they're trying to get people, do you know a terrorist? You know, that type of thing, where they want you to come in or call in about anything that you see suspect around, because this may be a possible terrorist. Now, within the war on drugs, for years they've had this apparatus set up, but they've also making it give people an incentive. So this person who, this cash attendant at the airlines, sees this black man with a wad of cash, calls the DEA. She gets 10% of the cut, the DEA takes his money. They don't even charge him with anything. They just take the money. So you have, just like within a war on terrorism, which is another aspect of the war by the state, which is just another aspect of war is made easy, a snitch society, and your rights, your basic rights, are being stripped away. Now, when many people look shocked about what's going on now in this current state of the war on terrorism, this has been happening for years, primarily to black people under the banner of a war on drugs. So in the same way that you see Padilla, strung out to dry and all of that type of stuff, where his basic rights were violated, no due process, same thing with this cat. They didn't charge him. They just took the money. So you can see, once again, the whole overlapping, especially as when Baum pointed out, 90%, 96% of the cash in the U.S. has microscopic elements of cocaine. And what do these clowns do after they seize your money? They put it right back into the banking system. This is all a way of further empowering the state apparatus, controlling stuff. Now, in the same way that Willie Jones found himself assumed to be a drug dealer, recently an article's come out where it goes, 4-year-old boy on government no-fly list. Edward Island's reaction to being on the government's quote-unquote no-fly list should have been the tip-off that he is no terrorist. Quote, "I don't want to be on the list. I want to fly and see my grandma," unquote, the 4-year-old boy said, according to his mother, Sojia Allen. And her son had trouble boarding planes last month because someone with the same name as Edward is on the government's terrorist watch list. Quote, "Is this a joke?" unquote, Allen recalled telling Continental Airlines agents December 21st. At Houston's Bush International Intercontinental Airport, quote, "You can tell he's not a terrorist," unquote. She said it took several minutes of pleading and a phone call by the ticket agent to get on the plane to New York. But later on, they found even more trouble trying to board planes and stuff. I mean, this shows how sick this whole aspect is. But in the same way that Willie Jones had his basic due processing rights kicked to the curb under the vehicle of a war on drugs, this war on terrorism, you know, this watch list and all of this type of stuff, with this whole beast eye apparatus looking and having people look over their every shoulder, is further eroding our basic lives. Because in the name of these wars by the empire, wars made easy is also a construct that war for them is a vehicle for them to more easily control us physically, economically, psychologically, socially, politically. Now, here Baum goes into how this seizure process has evolved. So, let's check this out.
Happens slowly. Civil forfeiture, the idea that the police can take property that is offensive to the law without due process, is a long-standing, with the First Continental Congress passed a law like that, having to do with slave ships. That means they could take property that is dangerous or offensive to the law, even if the owner is not present. A bank robber's gun, during Prohibition, barrels of whiskey. Stuff that is obviously dangerous, offensive to the law, can be taken. Then there's criminal forfeiture, which grows out of the RICO laws in the 70s, in which losing your property is a part of the punishment. If you're convicted of a crime, you can lose your property. And that was extended so that if you, let's say, are organized crime and you then invest your ill-gotten gains in a legitimate business, the legitimate business could be seized. happened was, beginning in Jimmy Carter's presidency, this is not something we can necessarily thank just conservative Republicans for. Beginning in Jimmy Carter's presidency, the two types of forfeiture began to be blended. The low standard of proof in civil forfeiture met the extended reach of criminal forfeiture. And we now have a situation where, as you say, on mere suspicion, police can seize your house, your bank account, the money in your pocket, your car, if they tell a judge, we believe this to be ill-gotten gains. You can then sue them to get your money back, but that is at your expense, you initiating the procedure.
So once again, this is why I constantly remind slaves to not let up on the Democratic Party. These guys just hand the baton off from one administration to another, and then just have a joint slave ship auctioning sales of us and our rights in Congress and in Senate. That's all that's going on there. These are just auctioning centers for our basic humanity internally in this country and externally on this global plantation. Now here, the civil forfeiture aspect was developed by these merchants of death. And then the criminal aspect expanded, you know, through the RICO law and all of that. But during whose administration? Democrat, Jimmy Carter. They merged the low standard of civil forfeiture and extended it with the criminal forfeiture, where they just merged. And now it's blossomed into, and this has been going on for years, where a pig, without even charging you, can go running up to the judge and start stripping you of your house, your bank account, under allegations of you being locked within the drug world, you know, you a participant of selling drugs. So here you have the expansion once again of the whole state apparatus over people's basic rights without any due process. And if you want to fight that, you don't have a right to counsel, because they're not charging you personally, they're charging your property under the whole asset forfeiture. But if they frozen or seized your bank account and your house, your car, your other means of survival, then how can you even go against them from a standpoint of getting a lawyer, unless you have resources outside of yourself, you know, friends, family members, and all of that type of stuff. But that would then further increase the strain and stress that you're under. But see, these guys have used this apparatus for years. This is nothing new that they've done. And you can see how this same type of encroachment on our basic rights has overlapped with the war on terror apparatus. Because for the empire, these are all wars made easy. Now here, Diane Baum goes into how the L.A. Sheriff Department plotted to seize a man's property under the banner of a war on drugs, where, as we know, these are all different forms of wars by the empire made easy.
Detective decided that he was going to get this ranch, basically. This was in the opinion of the Ventura County DA, who later investigated this. They ended up killing the man. They ended up killing a 61-year-old millionaire who was living on his ranch because in a huge drug raid looking for marijuana plants that never existed. The man was completely innocent, and he ended up dead. He beat down his door at dawn, right, and he, thinking somebody was coming in his house to kill him, walked into his hallway with a gun, and the sheriff's deputy involved shot him and killed him. Again, when he investigated, the Ventura County DA concluded that it was all about a desire to seize the ranch. No, it is very rare that police are prosecuted. The court has gone along with this every step of the way. Just this week, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that it is illegal for police to completely search a car for drugs, even if the original stop was only for a traffic violation, even in cases where the police were obviously making the traffic stop because they wanted to search the car for drugs. This was a case that involved two black men in a car, and the police wanted to search the car of two black men.
And once again, you can see how this parallels the searching aspect of people who look quote-unquote Mideastern to them, or are of Arab descent, and how in the same way that the courts, and they went through this whole process, starting in the 90s, the mid-90s, allowing them to have the power to search people's cars for drugs, even though that's the only reason why they stopped them, and they didn't have any justifiable reason on stopping them in the first place, other than they wanted to search their car. No due process, nothing. But under this whole war on drugs mantra, just like in this war on terrorism mantra, the rights are stripped away, the courts empower the police apparatus to further increase their leverage against the masses of people. Now, what's also fascinating is that you have a situation where, you know, concerning this rancher who ended up being killed by these cops in the LA Sheriff Department. How it initially started was they wanted the ranch because they just wanted the ranch for economic reasons and so on and so forth. And they knew that if they used the apparatus, the whole mechanism of seizing the property under the banner of war on drugs, they would get a cut. So a cop flying over in a helicopter claimed that he saw marijuana plants not even growing from the ground of this guy, but hanging on a tree. Under that, they were able to go in after this guy's property. They do it in the middle of the night, like Bomb talks about. This guy has no idea what's going on. He thinks people were breaking into his house, which they were. It was cops breaking into his house. He gets his gun, they shoot him and kill him, so on and so forth. So here you have this individual killed under this war on a drugs vehicle. So the way that the population is labeled a suspect and their assets, even though we know there's other there's other motives involved. It's the same way that within the context of the war on terrorism, the state has been able to plunge its way into other people's territories, like Iraq, under the banner of wanting to fight a war on terrorism, quote unquote. But we know that just like in the sheriff's department, there were other ulterior motives being vacillated out. Well, within the U.S. imperial context, there are obviously other imperial motives. Oil. But they use the context of a war on terrorism to justify their confiscation of other people's property, their oil, their resources, for their own further enrichment and control. In the same way that the sheriff's department, under the banner of war on drugs, used the war on drugs construct to seize and goose-stepped their way into this person's property for their own personal enrichment. And since their enrichment for all of these structures is tied in to the obliteration of other people's basic human rights, you can see how, for once again, the war, these wars made easy, is something that the state apparatus easily slips into. From these little wretched cops, to Halliburton, to Big Oil, to the philosophies of the neocon, which is tied into the whole imperial structure, wars made easy. They may use different terms: war on drugs, war on crime, war on guns. It's just a war on us. But unless we assess how overall this mechanism is working, these will continue to be wars made easy. Now, Baum now goes into what is the drug dealer profile. You know, we know of the quote-unquote profile of the terrorist suspect. Well, long before the terrorist suspect was created in the name of a war on terror, let's check out the drug dealer's profile suspect image. Check this out.
It's young black men. I mean, let's not forget that a third of the young black men in this country are under some form of correctional control. Jail, prison, probation, or parole. We've criminalized an entire generation of black men. What that tells their children, I can only shudder to think. There's a great bit in the book. The University of Virginia Law School totaled up, made a list of all of the drug courier profile cases that the DEA had made, and to write down the characteristics that the DEA had claimed indicated to them that this person was a drug dealer when they stopped him or her in the airport. And they included deplaning from the middle of the plane, deplaning from the front of the plane, deplaning from the back of the plane, walking fast to the terminal, walking slowly through the terminal, walking at average speed through the terminal, appearing nervous, appearing calm. In other words, anybody. Black male is the most dangerous thing to be. I mean, the LA Police Department during the 1980s arrested at one time or another three quarters of all the black men in LA between 16 and 35. That's three quarters of all of them. That includes the police officers, that includes the stockbrokers, that includes the choir boys. That's everybody. At one time or another, if you're a black man and you lived in LA, you have a 75% chance that you spent some time in the LA County lockup. And African Americans understand this. This has been largely a war on African Americans, and it has been since Nixon. And I've got to add this. I interviewed 175 people to do this book, starting with John Ehrlichman, coming right up through to the Clinton. And they astounded me with their candor at how explicitly they understood this to be a political construct from the start. This has never been about protecting the public health from potentially dangerous substances. And the drug czars and the people who worked for the drug czars and the various people who worked on Capitol Hill, for whom we have to thank for this drug policy, told me that in their words. This is not me divining their motives and reading between the lines and reading into what they might have said. They were extremely explicit. John Ehrlichman said to me, "We knew we could not make it illegal to be young or poor or black in the United States, but we could criminalize their common pleasure." This has been political from the start.
So here you have it once again, how this whole mechanism truly works out on Sam's plantation. When you have a situation where the DEA's profile for a drug suspect is one, basically being black, but leaving from the middle of the plane, front of the plane, back of the plane, walking fast, slow, average speed, appearing nervous, appearing calm, it makes it so clear what this is all about and how they further target and demonize a particular population, condition the overall population to accept this, to further erode the overall rights of the masses of people. So, in the same way that currently they are now using this vehicle within the war on terror on Mideast, South Asian, quote-unquote, looking people, it's the same way that they've long instituted this against the black population. And when, as Baum points out, we're in L.A., you had at a point where three-fourths of all black males found themselves under the cage, the iron cage of the beast, then that's more than clear, or should be, what's going on. Now, as been noted, this from war on drugs to war on terrorism is a political construct. And it has been, like the war on drugs, a political construct from the beginning. Here you have Ehrlichman talking about we couldn't make it illegal to be young, poor, and black, but we could criminalize their common pleasures. Once again, you have a situation where the war on terrorism is a political construct. And in the same way that Baum talked about how the war on drugs is not to protect the public health, neither is the war on terrorism. This is the state using all of its diabolical apparatus to terrorize the masses. But since there has historically been so little willingness to accept the hardcore racist economic political attack that has been happening towards black people and insert it into a real dialogue of an understanding of what this machine truly represents and how, yes, the Democrats and Republicans play a pivotal role in administering this death mechanism out. You have people now acting shocked under this banner of war on terrorism when it's obvious to see a core part of its roots have been sprouting up within the forms of the war on drugs. But once again, so much of the social justice movement is in such a denial and hates to confront the racist apparatus that is at the core of this economic machine order. And how, as we've gone over in the economic color of whiteness, you can't look at the construct of whiteness as this some kind of cultural thing. Whiteness is in itself is a political, social, and economic construct to maintain economic, social, political order and control. So those ruling circles within that position use that political apparatus to maintain the vision and the social apparatus that they see fit. And an important construct to that is having a war on black folks and using that to further isolate that pivotal community and also the masses of people who are in the servant and slave class throughout this country. Now next, Baum goes into Nixon's drug strategies and how, just like in the war on terrorism, you can play basically the fear factor game, the script, to traumatize the dumps in America to do what the rulers want and have them give up what they don't even know they have a right to. So check this out.
So, you know, the Nixon White House had this shorthand, as it was explained to me by several people who worked there, the young, the poor, and the black. That's how they used to define everybody else who was not their constituency. And Nixon's Law and Order campaign in 68, and then staying in the White House, depended on mobilizing white middle-class resentment against the anti-war left and blacks in the inner cities. I mean, you got to remember, in the context, it appeared to frightened white middle-class people that the country was coming unglued. If you watch TV then, and I went back doing this book and watched old television, you know, evening news shows, and, you know, first there was a scene from Columbia University with riot sticks and tear gas and police, and then you switched, and then they would go to downtown Dayton, Ohio, and it was the same thing, you know, riot sticks and tear gas and police, and it really did appear that the country was coming apart, and people were very frightened by that. Nixon won the White House by capitalizing on that fear, and he held the White House by capitalizing on that fear. And drugs were a convenient code for hippies who smoked pot and blacks who used heroin, and it was a way to get at these populations. I had a marvelous stroke of luck in that Bob Haldeman's diary was published right while I was doing the research for this book. And there's a marvelous line in there in which Haldeman records, quote, "President Nixon emphasized that the whole problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so."
Now, it can't get much rawer and more apparent than that. Here you have a situation where Nixon's strategy that he actually inherited from, in part, Strom Thurmond, part of the Southern strategy, was to divide part of the base of the Democrats and to help regiment large portions of the white population into identifying with their whiteness as opposed to the class affiliations with the masses of black people and youth at the time during the 60s who were involved in anti-war campaigns, so on and so forth. So the young, the poor, and the black construct was developed. And to make them look like alien outsiders who are corroding the whole fabric of the American society. So they play this little nationalistic card, which the American population is so willing to do, especially when you wave the banner of a war. So the analysis of during that time, how Sam was already engaged in a war, that being a war against the Vietnamese people, is not critiqued by elements within this society in the way it should have been, you know, as an imperial war. Of course, many people ended up being against it, but that, a lot of that had to do with them getting their ass shot off or their sons getting their ass shot off. But here, they go into the next stage of the war. And they had already been in some other wars, which was a war on a population of black folks through a spatial deconcentration, you know, of the communities and all of that. But they used this drug war aspect under the banner of law and order and all of that other type of stuff. And here Haldeman, a partner of Nixon, what did Haldeman himself say was their real motivation, just like we went over about their motivation in other aspects of the war, the sheriff's department and the seizure of the house, and big oil and others, and the seizure of Iraqi's oil field. Haldeman on Nixon said, quote, "President Nixon emphasized that the whole problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so." Unquote. Boy George, now, amongst his other strategies that he has going on in his various wars that have been handed down to him by both Democrats and Republicans. One of Boy George's strategies is to emphasize that the whole problem in this country in the name of a war on terrorism is really the Arabs, Mideast people, people aligned with them. And the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so. In other words, the same strategy that Nixon actually used and Haldeman is quoted as saying is can easily be adapted to what Boy George is currently doing in his current war on terrorism. And much of the Gumpified American population is going for it. And since much of the social progressive movement has failed to really address the overall aspect of what these lockdown projects in the inner city mean for the rights of all people, when they lock down certain project housings and you have to have ID to go into them, all under the banner of war on drugs, where certain neighborhoods are cordoned off and you have to show ID to get into these neighborhoods. Well, this is all the same type of apparatus that we've seen currently going on in Fallujah. The same game and the same enemy. Under the same, well, more or less construct that they developed. Because for them, wars are made easy. Now, and like this war on terrorism, this war on drugs has economic implications for the masses of people in this society. Here's what I mean. Check this out.
We spend on the state, local, and federal levels more on the war on drugs today than we do as a nation on private health insurance. Just the federal drug budget, which is a small portion of this, merely the federal drug budget, exceeds the combined budgets of the Commerce, State, and Interior departments. This is big money. That's why I'm hoping that this is going to become an issue for conservative Americans who profess to be upset about Washington's deficit spending, about entrenched bureaucracies perpetuating government programs that don't work, who profess to be angry about Washington intruding on the lives of individuals, Washington usurping state and local control. This is the daddy of them all in those regards. And it has been immune from criticism because, again, the drug czars were very candid with me about this. Beginning with Jimmy Carter's second drug czar, the drug office has seen itself as not just protecting the public from potentially dangerous substances, but changing the way Americans think and changing the way Americans talk. And there was a deliberate, explicit effort to close the debate on drug abuse and drug policy. And again, this is not me reading into their motives. They explained this to me. They said, we did not want people talking about hard and soft drugs. We didn't want people talking about the difference between drug use and drug abuse. We wanted all contact with all illegal drugs declared equally bad, equally dangerous, equally illegal, and give no quarter at all to any contact with these drugs, and any way to discuss it. And because we can't talk about it, I mean, that's what really frightens me about the drug war. It's forbidden speech to question the type of prohibition.
Forbidden speech. Now, when Boy George and company were first getting ready to charge off into this imperial war under the banner of war on terrorism, it was forbidden speech for many people to even challenge or try to discuss what this war on terrorism means and what are the implications of allowing the state apparatus carte blanche to go haywire on the world population. That was considered treasonous. Professors at universities that sought to discuss this and have, you know, dialogue about this were put on watch lists. People who talked at 24-hour fitnesses found themselves put in a situation, you know, who at 24-hour fitnesses who questioned some of the motivation and prior history of the U.S. Empire involvement in foreign intervention, found themselves visited by FBI agents. The list goes on. Forbidden speech. Well, within the war on drugs, as Baum was pointing out, a whole mindset was developed and orchestrated by the state that for those who wanted to question the legitimacy of the war on drugs, who wanted to seek to find what were some of the motivations behind this, found themselves ostracized, questioned, quote unquote, and on and on. And this is how the vehicle of oppression expands itself out. And when you have pivotal issues like these types of wars by the state be able to be orchestrated, you can see how basic rights further erode step by step, period by period, by this whole beast apparatus. No, it hasn't been a situation where people's health care under the current war on terrorism has been taking massive hits. In actuality, as Baum pointed out, when you have more money being spent under this whole war on drugs than on the whole private health insurance apparatus, this has been a long time developing. And where have the Democrats been? Well, under the flag of a war, where wars are made easy. Easy for those who are aligned with the apparatus of the order. Wars made easy, in reality, is a war on us and our basic rights and humanity in this country and throughout the world, which is why those who are aligned with this beast apparatus, wars are something they so love. Day by day, year by year, and stripping of rights by rights. On Sam's plantation. Hold on a sec.
Imagine a world without murder.
I lost my best friend.
I lost my aunt.
I lost my dad.
I lost my father.
I lost my wife.
Just 6 years ago, the homicide rate in this country had reached epidemic proportions. It seemed that only a miracle could stop the bloodshed. But instead of one miracle, we were given three, the precognitives. Within just 1 month under the pre-crime program, the murder rate in the District of Columbia was reduced 90%.
They were going to be waiting for me in the car.
He was going to rape me.
I was going to be stabbed.
Right here.
Within a year, pre-crime effectively stopped murder in our nation's capital.
In the 6 years we've been conducting our little experiment, there hasn't been a single murder.
And now pre-crime can work for you.
We want to make absolutely certain that every American can bank on the utter infallibility of the system. And to ensure that what keeps us safe will also keep us free.
Pre-crime, it works. On Tuesday, April 22nd, vote yes on the National Pre-Crime Initiative.
How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
For a small planet.
MCI. The global internet became their trading floor.
Gene is creeping good things to life.
Visa Gold is everywhere you want to be.
Things are about to get out of hand.
And for people like these, an incredible weapon has been created.
Power of a computer in the palm of your hand.
Just like the American Empire, just like how it is a bully, imperialist order, and only really gets the message when resistance is put at maximum effort to let the thug know that he's about to get and is going to continuously get crushed square off in his jaw as long as he's in existence. That's in essence what one has to do with the order's little Igors. Take a loudmouth Bill O'Reilly, who often makes a name for himself yelling and chastising and threatening people and on and on. We're going to dip into this a little bit in this Ventures in Corporate Media Land segment called The Glass Jaw Bully, and see how this glass jaw bully typically operates. But let's see what happens when just a few people decide to swing back a little bit. So First, let's check out old Glass Jaw Bully in his normal chastising mode. So check this out.
But there is no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, that the Times has been unfair in its coverage of the Bush White House, and the paper also routinely uses personal attacks to hurt people with whom it disagrees. If that does not stop Bill Keller and Frank Rich, to name the two main culprits, will not have a happy new year. As they say in the auction world, fair warning. As far as the NSA story is concerned, there seem to be valid arguments on both sides, and I don't know at this point who's right. I do know the debate is important. So summing up for 2006, robust debate is in, personal attacks are out. That is a memo. Continuing now with our lead story, the hate Bush media. Joining us from Washington, Fox News analyst Juan Williams, and from Boston, Fox News analyst Marianne Marsh. Both are Democrats.
All right, so here you have him, you know, throwing out his little threats to New York Times, going into things about the hate Bush media, and on and on and on. Now, I don't know who he really thinks he is, but that's him in, you know, a fairly typical mode, sounding off, trying to bully people, getting his listeners to respond to hot button issues, you know, gays and the Boy Scouts, a war on Christmas, all this nonsense and stuff, and trying to bludgeon people who he just doesn't agree with, or feels goes outside of the script that he's reading from, you know, from Rupert and the rest of his masters within the whole corporate structure. Now, a little while back, the Glass Jaw Bully had on old Phil Donahue. Now, Donahue's not some raging radical or anything like that, but Donahue is just someone who's not intimidated by the Glass Jaw Bully. So let's see how a debate, quote unquote, goes with Glass Jaw Bully O'Reilly when he's doesn't intimidate the person he's confronting, and that person is willing to look him eye to eye and shoot questions right back at him. So check this out.
Thanks for staying with us, and Bill O'Reilly in the Fact and Follow-Up segment tonight. While most politicians have stayed far away from Cindy Sheehan because of her somewhat radical views, a few showbiz people have embraced her. In the past, Ms. Sheehan has criticized Israel, saying it is occupying Palestine, has called Iraqi insurgents freedom fighters, has accused Americans of killing people ever since we stepped on this continent, has threatened Hillary Clinton with the loss of her job unless she calls for a pullout of U.S. troops from Iraq, and has called the U.S. action against Afghanistan a failure. Quite a resume. And with us now is Phil Donahue, who supports Ms. Sheehan's dissent. So I'm assuming you don't support all her positions that
Let's understand what's happening here. Once again, we have a woman who got to be just a little too famous for the people who support this war. A minority of the American population, by the way. And so the effort to marginalize this woman is underway, and you're helping out.
I'm the leader of the pack. I'm the leader of the pack.
First of all, Cindy Sheehan is one tough mother, and nothing you say or anyone else are going to slow her down.
No, that's fine. She has a right
to do that. You can't hurt her. She's already taken the biggest punch of nose that a woman can take. She's lost a son.
Oh, okay.
She's lost a child.
But look, I'm not putting words in her mouth.
By the way, she is going to be at the center of one of the largest rallies since the Vietnam War. Proud, patriotic Americans who will show up in Washington this week for one of the most massive, largest demonstrations, protest demonstrations,
okay. And we'll cover
right
it.
Outside the president's window.
And we'll
and
cover
Fox
it.
Fox is in the business of saying that this woman is somehow saying un-American things, hyperbole.
No.
Listen to what she
said. Nobody said she said anything un-American. We say that her positions are radical, and they are radical.
Let me tell you what's radical. What's radical is to send more Americans to die in this war, which is a monumental blunder by a president who swaggered us into it with, by the way, the at least tacit approval of the Democratic Party.
You know,
there's a
radical,
lot of sin to go around here.
What's radical for you?
You want to send more people to this war?
Listen,
is that your position?
If we cut and run out of there like you want to do, we would be putting every American in 1,000 times more jeopardy than they're in now.
We're going to cut and run anyway,
well,
Bill.
Well, that's your opinion.
My opinion. American military leaders have said we're going to draw down beginning next year.
The difference between drawing down and cutting and running.
Well,
you're a cut and run guy, and I don't want my family in
danger. You want to stay the course, don't you?
Look. Here's what I want to do. I want to give the Iraqis a chance to train their army so they can defeat these people who are trying to turn it into a terrorist state.
Bill.
That's what I want to do.
Bill.
Go.
This Iraq was not a terrorist state.
Oh, no.
I hope I don't patronize you for saying
again. He was Saddam, great guy.
Saddam was a bastard, but he was our bastard.
He wasn't anybody.
Donald Rumsfeld shook his hand in the 80s.
Well, that's great.
You saw the pictures. Now, listen. You wouldn't send your children to this war, Bill.
My nephew
Nobody.
Just enlisted in the Army. You
your
don't know
nephew.
What the hell you're talking
very good.
About.
Very good. Congratulations.
Yeah, and he's a patriot, so don't denigrate his service or I'll boot you right off the set.
I'm not.
That boy made a decision to serve his country. Do not denigrate him or you're out of here.
I'm not Jeremy Glick, Billy.
That's
you
right. A little bit more intelligence
me.
Than
I'm
he
not
is.
Somebody you can come and just spew
don't
all
Don't tell me
your
I wouldn't send my kid.
Loud doesn't mean
my
right.
My nephew just enlisted. You don't know what you're
your
talking
about. Your nephew is not your kid. You
He's
are
my
like,
blood.
You are part of a loud group of people who want to prove they're tough. And send other people's kids to war to make the case.
You have no clue about how to fight a war on terror or how to defend your country. You are clueless, so is Machine. And for Machine to say that the insurgents have a right to kill Americans and you're shaking her hand, you ought to just walk away.
How many more young men and women are you going to send to have their arms and legs blown off?
Hey, this is a
so
war
that you can be tough
terror.
And point at people in a kind of cowardly way, people like Jeremy Glick, who comes on to in memory of his parents, and you go
Jeremy
on
Glick
him like a big bully.
Hey.
Billy, you have to be, you have
Mr.
to feel
Donnie,
sorry
with all due
that.
Respect.
Have you apologized to him for
Baloney.
That?
Baloney. Jeremy Glick came on this program
about?
And accused the President of the United States of orchestrating 9/11. That's what he did. Right in after 9/11 happened. You know what the pain that brought the families who lost people in 9/11?
This war.
You buy into left-wing propaganda,
this war,
and you're a mouthpiece for it. Go ahead.
This war is not fair to the American troops. This war is unconstitutional. This war turned its back on the people who framed the most fabulous document in the history of civilization. I speak of the United States Constitution.
All right. Why isn't the Democratic
Party
speaking that way?
I'm sorry that it isn't. I am. But let's understand something.
Are we all so misguided?
21 Democrats in the Senate voted against this war, as well as Jeffords, an independent, and may the Lord shine his blessings down upon Lincoln Chafee.
I'm going to say
I'm almost finished, Billy. Lincoln Chafee, the only Republican in the Senate to vote against this war. We should be building statues to all these people. October 2002, they stood up to a president and they knew that, first of all, only Congress can declare war. Why is that unimportant to you, Billy?
Listen,
why
it's
can't
not,
you
I'm not.
Become the patriot that your loud voice proclaims
loud
to be
voice.
And stand behind the Constitution and insist that we never go to war again without the approval and
that's
consent
what we
of
have
the United
the
States Congress.
Congress. If they want to take action, they can take action. Now, I'm going to say something. I'm going to give the last word. The Iraq war is not something that I embrace. It absolutely could be
well,
a tactical error. All right?
It's hard to know this.
Listen to me, and then you're going to have the last word. Not something to embrace. Could be a tactical error. Optional war. And we have not waged it the way I had hoped we would wage it.
But what?
But. We are in a war on terror. We are in a war on terror. Our cause
is
noble. It
has nothing to do with a war on terror.
Yes, it does. And if you don't understand geopolitics, if you don't understand Iraq would be a terrorist state if we pulled out of there, you don't know anything.
Poorly planned and poorly executed, but Bill O'Reilly wants to send more kids to fight and die. We've already had almost 2,000. Just let me have the last word. In the last year, two things have doubled. The number of dead American troops in Iraq have doubled.
from over 1,000 to almost 2,000. You know what else doubled, Billy? The price of Halliburton stock.
All right.
From $33 to $66. That doesn't shame you. That doesn't make you wonder.
Not
upset
by Halliburton stock.
This is an enterprise that is worth the support of the American people. We need you at this rally on Saturday, Billy.
Okay.
We need you out there in front of it.
But I
to
do,
be a, to protest.
I'm not going to be
there
at the rally.
There is no democracy without dissent. You should be proud of people
I
who
am,
stand up and dissent.
I respect your
a
dissent.
A lot of fine men went and died.
All right,
to give
you
me
got it.
Freedom.
You got it. I respect your dissent. I think you're way off in your analysis.
You want to send more people
terror.
To die in Iraq? Is that my? Is that
want to win the war in Iraq?
Win. What does win mean?
It means
tell me
those
what
people
mean.
Have a chance at democracy.
I got to go. How long is that going to take?
I got to go.
How long is that going to take?
Those people deserve a chance at freedom. Thank you for coming in.
So you can see, you know, Donahue just challenged him back a little bit. It wasn't even real ferocious. He just wasn't intimidated, like many people amazingly are. The next thing you know, O'Reilly's stumbling all over himself and saying stuff like, the Iraq war is not something I embraced. It's not waged the way I like. But then, in that same sentence, talks about how its cause is noble, though. Now, how is the cause noble when it's not something he embraced? It's not something, it's not being waged in the way he likes? He knows about the torture that's gone on in Abu Ghraib and other places, the use of chemical and biological or chemical weapons. Like white phosphorus. He knows about the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction, something that he said would change his opinion if they were not found back in the day, yet he still holds on. See, this is just a little doughboy for the empire, and Donahue was able to expose it just by challenging him a little bit, not being intimidated by him. Now, you saw O'Reilly use some of his tactics, like, you know, don't denigrate him, you know, his little relative, or I'll boot you right out of here. But, you know, Donahue just sat there and looked at him and said, I'm not Jeremy Glick, you know. In other words, he's not intimidated by all this shouting and hooping, you know, hooping and hollering and stuff like that. So, O'Reilly falls back on what kind of phrases. That Donahue, according to O'Reilly, has no clue how to fight a war on terrorism, how to defend the country. So right there you see O'Reilly saying things like, and aligning that the fight for the war on terrorism is connected with defending the country. Now, what did we just go over? How the whole apparatus of this machine was using the war on drugs and has used the war on drugs as protection, as safety internally for the country. Even though we heard right within their own voices that that was the last thing and concern that they had on their mind. As Haldeman himself said back in the day, that quote, President Nixon emphasized that the whole problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be to finding ways, a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so. Unquote. So, this was not safety from drugs. This was a way of demonizing a portion of the population to further expand their control economically, politically over the masses of people while pulverizing an important component, an important element that has historically been a key component of resisting the order. But see, O'Reilly just uses the same trick that his predecessors have. So, when Donahue asked O'Reilly, the glass jaw bully, you know, what does win mean? O'Reilly doesn't have any real response. He diatribes back to this whole aspect of a democracy and freedom for the Iraqi people. Yet, in the same way that we know it's an illusion that they said that this whole war on drugs is a way of safeguarding the rights of the people within America, we know their real motivations for goose-stepping into Iraq. And we know that right at that, in the same way that under the war on drugs banner, rights for the American population were and are vastly eroded, basic human rights for the masses of Iraqi people under this war on terrorism has been eroded. Rights for women have been severely crushed under this whole banner of imperial intervention. But see, when you challenge the glass jaw bully a little bit, you see how fragile he really is. Now next, let's go back to O'Reilly in his classic attack mode. This is with one of his callers. Let's just check out how this played itself out when the question of Sheehan came up. Check it out.
But I tend to side with Letterman's viewpoints, particularly the Cindy Sheehan issue. I think it's wrong to attack and vilify someone like Sheehan, and you did the same thing with Jeremy Glick, and I think it's deplorable.
Yeah,
let
me ask you a question here. You just heard her soundbite saying that terrorists who kill babies, women, anybody, are freedom fighters. Do you believe that?
Well,
do you believe that?
I don't agree with it.
Okay.
However, I don't think it's fair to attack and vilify.
Of course, I'm not attacking and vilifying. Hold it. All right, get rid of him. Not attacking and vilifying anybody. That comment that Cindy Sheehan puts forth to the American people, that these people are freedom fighters. Do you know how painful that is to people who have lost soldiers and Marines in Iraq? Yeah, she lost her son. We feel bad. I'm not vilifying the woman. I play her comments, and I tell you the truth. She's run by far-left elements who are using her. And she's dumb enough to allow it to happen. It's not a vilification. It's a fact.
Far-left elements. You know, people... See, this is a typical type of rhetoric by O'Reilly and company. People have heard me critique a number of these elements that I called in one of the shows Imperial Peace Advocates, because many of them, like Cindy Sheehan, while doing some good critique about the imperial apparatus, a whole core of them, like Sheehan had came out before the recent 2004 election, aligned themselves to voting with the Democrats. Now, however you rationalize it, as I've noted before, you can't call yourself a peace advocate or a nonviolent advocate if you align yourself or support the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is one of the most violent institutions on the planet. Its historical record bears that out. It practices violence. It uses violence not just in what it calls self-defense, but it goes on the offense. It uses it to achieve its goals. This is a party that has never renounced violence to achieve its ends. It has had presidents, congresspersons, legislators, all in service to the order, use violence to achieve geopolitical, economic, corporate means and stuff. So when you have this type of apparatus go on, and as we've noted before, how the war on drugs has been equally devastating internally to the fabric and the cohesion of the masses of people, especially a core component of it within this society, and how the Democratic Party has played a pivotal role in that apparatus, you can see that under their whole war made easy construct, that anyone who aligns themselves with the Democratic Party is in parcel part of the problem. You can't escape around that. So when you have O'Reilly talk about, you know, she's with far left elements and all of that type of stuff, you know, it's just rhetoric. And this is not a personal attack on, you know, her or anyone per se. This is just, are you down with the slaves or not? The slaves have a perspective. The slaves have a mode and code of attrition and conduct. And, you know, Skip getting caught in this vicious, violent cycle where you intentionally erode and gumpify yourself down and align yourself with vehicles that don't have your interest at heart. And the Democratic Party, which is as violent as any other institution on this planet at in this day and time, cannot be considered, by the slaves at least, allies. Now, here again, though, getting back to O'Reilly, when the glass jaw bully was on David Letterman's show, once again, not someone all hardcore, radical, or anything like that, and when he's in a situation where he can't cancel out his callers, you know, by having his little subjects flip the switch. Let's see how the glass jaw bully stands up to this, you know, talk show host, comedian, David Letterman. Check this out.
Soldiers and Marines are noble. They're not terrorists. And when people call them that, like Cindy Sheehan called the insurgents freedom fighters, we don't like that. It is a vitally important time in American history, and we should all take it very seriously. Be very careful with what we say.
Well, and you should be very careful with what you say also.
Give me an example.
How can you possibly take exception with the motivation and the position of someone like Cindy Sheehan?
Because I believe she's run by far-left elements in this country. I feel bad for the woman.
Have you lost family members in armed conflict?
No, I have not.
Well, then you can hardly speak for her, can you?
Right. I'm not speaking for her. All right, let me ask you this question.
Let's go back to your little
red and green
stories.
This is important. This is important. Cindy Sheehan lost a son, a professional soldier in Iraq, correct? She has a right to grieve any way she wants. She has a right to say whatever she wants. When she says to the public that the insurgents and terrorists are freedom fighters, how do you think, David Letterman, that makes people who've lost loved ones by these people blowing the hell out of them, how do you think they feel? What about their feelings, sir?
Well, what about why are we there in the first place?
We're there.
The president himself, less than a month ago, said we are there because of a mistake in intelligence. Well, whose intelligence? It was just somebody got off a bus and handed it to him?
No, it was
the intelligence gathered by his administration. Yeah. So why are we there in the first place? Well, I agree with you that we have to support the troops. They are there. They are the best and the brightest of this country. There's no doubt about that. And I also agree. But now we're in it, it's going to take a long, long time. People who expect it to be solved and wrapped up in a couple of years, it's unrealistic. It's not going to happen. However, that does not eliminate the legitimate speculation and concern and questioning of why the hell are we there to begin with?
If you want to question that and then revamp an intelligence agency that's obviously flawed, the CIA, okay? But remember, M16 in Britain said the same thing. Putin's people in Russia said the same thing, and so did Mubarak's intelligence agency in Egypt.
Well,
they
all that makes
said,
it all right.
The
intelligence
right.
across the board makes it all
it
right. That we're
make
there.
It right.
I'm very concerned about people like yourself who don't have nothing but endless sympathy for a woman like Cindy Sheehan. Honest to Christ.
No, I'm sorry.
Honest to Christ. No way you're gonna get me.
No way that a terrorist who blows up women
you
and
have
children.
You have children?
Yes, I do. Have a son the same age as yours. No way a terrorist who blows up women and children is going to be called freedom fighter on my program.
So once again, you see how easily Letterman is able to just kind of, you know, slap the glass jaw bully around. And of course, O'Reilly went back to his typical, you know, cliches about no way a terrorist is going to be called a freedom fighter and so on and so forth. Now, as many people know, we don't, there's all types of people over there in Iraq. And there's a whole lot of people who are resisting the American occupational forces, who of course couldn't be considered freedom fighters because many of them really don't have freedom, or at least the way the slaves would define it, on their mind for the masses of people. They're, you know, often people are there for their own geopolitical reasons. It could be part religious. It could be a core part of, you know, against occupation. But what society that they want, you know, is down with them. And the reason why I say that is that these guys often try to overgeneralize what it means to resist on certain levels and define in these rigid terms. Look, in the same way that during World War II, Sam ended up engaged against the German forces. Now, even though Sam was engaged against the Nazi forces, no one in their right mind, and I do mean in their right mind, would consider Sam and his forces freedom fighters. Sam wasn't over there fighting for freedom. It was just over there fighting for market expansionism and further maintenance and control for what it saw developing out of that imperial war. But this is an empire that had all kinds of connections with Adolf all throughout that period, from General Electric to Henry Ford. We've gone over this in Henry Ford in the Jews show, to IBM and the Holocaust madness and stuff, to a number of industrialists in this country wanting to implement fascism because they were envious of what the Nazis were doing, and they contacted Smedley Butler, the Brigadier General, to facilitate or orchestrate that thing, and they were going to give him troops and everything else, and he was going to overthrow the government, and they would, you know, have like a de facto dictatorship and stuff. This is what these clowns wanted here. Freedom was the last thing on these empire's mind. So for someone to engage, my point is, in various disputes, physical wars, etc., economic, it doesn't mean that they are quote-unquote a freedom fighter or not. This is just O'Reilly throwing words around, which is what you expect from someone as cynical and reckless and as diabolical as he is. Now, of course, Letterman, who basically just slapped O'Reilly around, but of course he's going to say his little cliché-ish things that are basically within the confines of the state, you know, that these soldiers are the best and brightest of this country. Many of them are what can be classified as in part victims of this ruling order, but in part suckers. And you have a contingent that are also adventure-seeking blood imperial molesters for the empire because they're just yahoos and stuff. So you have all types of people over there, and of course the aspect of those who are mercenaries, well, that we don't even need to go into them. But the soldiers and Marines, as O'Reilly started off saying, once again, they're noble and they're not terrorists. All one has to do at the end of the day is ask, whose interests are they fighting for? This is not a personal thing. Whose interest are they fighting for? It's not a personality thing. Your decision to align with certain forces defines, on a certain level, your role and your overall allegiance to a particular ideology, methodology, movement, and overall alignment. And if that machine, regardless of your personal personality, is moving in a way that is to further enrich a particular stratum within this society without regard of the basic human rights, then you're implicated in that barbarity because of the role that you play within it. That's just the real world. So in the same way that you saw, witnessed how a loud mouth like O'Reilly really has a glass jaw. He's just a glass jaw bully behind a pulpit. A pulpit of protection. But when those who are in a position or are willing and or are willing to just stand up to him, you see that that glass jaw basically comes shattering to the ground. In the same way that a slave say, if they don't want to bring the troops home, those who are resisting internationally against the imperial forces know that at the end of the day, they will be brought home in body bags and in West Oakland's head coffin. Either way, it's all right by us. Because when you fight for the empire, you too are a glass jaw bully for imperialism. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up. Slade tonight. It's just clear we can't let these glass jaw bullies and their wars made easy dictate the course that us slaves travel on. Actually, we have to crush these glass jaw bullies into the ground where they belong. Until the next time. Slave out.